The views expressed in this program are not necessarily those of FMR. Fine Music Radio. Book Choice with Paige Nick on FMR.
Hello and welcome to another episode, or as I like to think of it, another chapter of Book Choice on Fine Music Radio, your 1 hour book review and interview show that comes onto your airwaves or streams into your ears every second Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. right here on Fine Music Radio. My name is Paige Nick. I am the host of this show, and our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books, which means that every single one of the books you hear about on today's show is available for you at Exclusive Books. So we have a really different kind of show for you today. Normally, our show is jam-packed with books and books and books. We have tons and tons of recommendations for you. You know, I feel like this year has been on super high speed. Well, it has been for me. I don't know if you feel that way. And I feel like we're all just coming to the end of the year where we want to slow down a little bit, take a moment to ourselves, maybe pick up a couple of books, have a nice read, hopefully have a bit of a break, and get ready for, can you believe it, for 2026. So I thought, let's slow our show right down. And instead of having tons and tons and tons of books, we're just going to have a few, and we're going to spend quite a while with each of these titles, and we're going to talk about them for a little bit longer and give you a little bit more insight into what they're all about and who wrote them. So as usual, we have a mix of fiction and non-fiction. We're going to start with some local fiction. Riley Herbert Henry is here, and he's going to be talking about a book called Diplomatic Ties, which is by Mpho Boshego. This is really wonderful fiction. Mpho herself was a diplomat in Europe for a long time, and now she's written this very juicy kind of thriller genre fiction novel called Diplomatic Ties, which I think if anyone worked with her, they might see some people or some things they recognize. But it's pure fiction and it's a real great ride. This is a wonderful summer read. After that, Beryl Eichenberger is here, and she's going to be reviewing a massive global big hit, Wally Lam. That's a very famous author name. Actually, he's a household name by now. She's going to be chatting about his latest great big smash hit. It's called The River Is Waiting. After that, Riley Herbert Henry is back. He gives us a twofer this month. And this is going to be a really interesting segment. Riley Herbert Henry has actually read every single one of the books on the Booker shortlist. So he read them alongside the judges, and he followed the process really carefully. He had his pick for who he was hoping was going to win. And so he's joining us in a big segment to talk about his Booker shortlist lowdown and what he really thought of the 2025 Booker winner, which is called Flesh by David Salze. So he brings some real insight. Having read that entire shortlist, he brings some real insight into what won, what was shortlisted, what he thinks is missing. And he has some really interesting insights as well about the future of the Booker Prize. So that's going to be a very cool segment. And after that, two huge interviews. Our favorite here, our nonfiction journalist reviewer, Beverly Ruiz Miller, is here, and she's going to interview Lord Peter Hayne. He has a new book out. It's called Liberation and Corruption, Why Freedom Movements Fail. And they're going to be chatting right here about this book and also about freedom movements and about politics and about current affairs. And that's going to be a riveting interview that's coming up second to last on the show. And then last up, we're going to wrap up the show with Twangi Kulula chatting to Bruce Whitfield. Now, Bruce Whitfield is no stranger to this show, and he's no stranger to radio, and he's no stranger to books about money and business. His latest is called It's About Time, and it's about Time Bank. And the whole book is about banking beyond borders. I think it addresses the unbanked and what Time Bank has done in this country. Super interesting. That's by Adrian Saville and Bruce Whitfield, and Twangi Kulula will be right here in the studio with Bruce Whitfield chatting about that book. So as I mentioned, it's a much smaller show that we have for you this month. We've slowed everything down and we're giving each book a lot more time. But in essence, it's actually a much bigger show because we've got these massive big hits. We've got a review of all the Booker shortlist and the winner Flesh. We've got a huge interview with Peter Hayne and an interview with Bruce Whitfield about the banking book. Each of these segments is going to be bookended by some very, very fine music. This is Fine Music Radio after all. So without further ado, let me just get right into it. We're going to go straight into this review with Riley Herbert-Henry of Diplomatic Ties by Paul Boschego.
From the bustling township of Mamelodi to the polished halls of Brussels, Diplomatic Ties follows Mbalilanga, a woman determined to carve a place for herself in a world built to keep her out. Paul Boschego's debut novel is both a gripping political drama and an intimate psychological portrait, a story about power, ambition, and the dangerous price of desire. Mbali is a rising South African diplomat, sharp, disciplined, and deeply aware of what her presence represents. Every success she achieves feels hard-won, every misstep fatal. Having fought her way from modest beginnings to the glittering nerve center of European diplomacy, she has learned to move carefully through rooms where language, charm, and silence all carry strategic weight. But when an illicit affair threatens to unravel everything she has built, Mbali finds herself caught between the demands of duty and the pull of longing. The stakes are personal and political. In Boschego's world, the two are inseparable. Behind the courteous smiles of diplomacy lies a theatre of ambition and betrayal, where secrets are traded like currency, and intimacy becomes the most dangerous negotiation of all. Boschego writes with remarkable interiority. Much of the novel's tension unfolds within Mbali's private reckoning. The steady erosion of her certainty, the clash between her desire for independence and her need to belong. Through her eyes, we glimpse the invisible labour of women in power. The constant recalibration of self, the performance required to be seen, heard, and respected. The novel moves with cinematic precision, shifting from the vivid textures of Mamelodi, its sound, its heat, its relentless momentum, to the cool detachment of Brussels, where emotion is something to be managed, not expressed. Boschego's prose is sleek yet intimate, capturing both the central pulse of desire and the icy restraint of diplomacy. At its core, Diplomatic Ties asks what freedom looks like when the systems you serve are designed to contain you. Mbali's struggle is not simply to survive scandal, but to define herself outside the expectations of others. As a woman, a diplomat, and a South African navigating post-colonial corridors of power, it's a bold, stylish debut that refuses easy moral boundaries. Readers drawn to the moral tensions of Helen Walsh's The Exposure or the political complexity of Adichie's Americana will find the same depth here, but with a distinctly South African heartbeat. The novel is a taut, intelligent investigation into ambition, vulnerability, and the cost of having everything you ever wanted, only to wonder what part of yourself you lost along the way. Diplomatic Ties is written by Paul Boschego and published by Pan Macmillan South Africa.
So next up, Beryl Eichenberger is here, and she's going to bring us a review of the latest Wally Lam novel called A River Is Waiting. The second it came out, it instantly went to massive bestseller status. Everybody always waits for a big Wally Lam release, and so this has been very much anticipated. And Beryl's going to tell us all about that. But I wanted to say something before that. I don't know about you, but I've noticed something in the literary landscape just this year. Rivers have become a huge theme in titles of books. And I can think of 8 of them off the top of my head. Not only the one that we're about to review, the Wally Lam, The River Is Waiting, but there's also been Go as a River by Shelley Reed, Is a River Alive by Robert McFarlane, The River We Remember by William Kent Kruger, Elizabeth Gilbert brought out her book, All the Way to the River, Sibokazi Jonas with Weeping Becomes a River, even Elif Shafak brought out There Are Rivers in the Sky, and Mary Alice Monroe with Where the Rivers Merge. All of these have been big hits in their own right, and all of them carry rivers in the title. Not to mention The Covenant of Water, which has also been huge, but that wasn't a river, but still water. So it's just made me wonder that rivers are such a big trend. You know, go as a river, come as a river, there are rivers in the sky, cry me a river. It just feels like we're going through a river explosion or a river revival or a river overflow or something. Maybe we're all just river riveted. So I don't know, how many of those river books have you read? And have you noticed this trend? Beryl Eichenberger, have you noticed this trend? Welcome to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio. Tell us all about Wally Lamb's latest, The River is Waiting.
So much has been written about Wally Lamb and his compassionate writing, his imperfect people, his unerring eye, ear, and signature heart. His latest novel, The River is Waiting, is all this and more. A deeply felt story, gut-wrenching, heartbreaking. I ran the gamut of emotions as I read, sometimes laying the book down as I caught my breath, feeling that jolt in my stomach as tragedy unfolded, gasping out loud. It is one of those stories that grips you page after page, and at the risk of sounding like a fangirl, I am hooked. I'm a newcomer to his book. Somehow they slipped under my radar, but we'll be looking out for his others now. Corby, and Emily Ledbetter, a regular couple, with toddler twins. She's an elementary school teacher. He is a graphic artist, but not at the moment. He's been retrenched, so he's house husband. He adores his kids and is a good and loving father. But he's struggling to find a new job, the constant rejection feeding his anxiety. Pills and booze, only in small doses, you know, unknown to Emily, are keeping him afloat. But when he causes the tragedy that tears their family apart, it's a downward spiral. Written in the first-person present tense, we're so close to Corby that as the tension builds, I could feel my breath coming sharper until my own anguished cry of, oh no! And this is within the first 12 pages. When the emotions are tempered in that way, you know this is a book that will take you down a new road. Corby is an honest man. He owns up to his addiction, doesn't take legal loophole, and lands himself in jail for 3 years. Lamb understands the prison system, having taught for many years in correctional facilities. For Corby, suffering from guilt, grief, and that emptiness of soul that comes after loss, it's a life unknown, fractured, seemingly without hope. Brutality and injustice are the norm, but then there are small glimmers of kindness that slowly seep into him. Manny, the flamboyant cellmate who cares. The librarian, Mrs. Millman, who fans his artistic ability. His mother, who believes in him. And his own kindness to Solomon, the young troubled teenager who should never have been put in this facility. Standout characters who are flesh and blood. But the themes are many. Death, grief, addiction, guilt, brutality, fear, bullying, expectations, inequality, hope. But overall, it is forgiveness. Will Emily ever forgive him? A hovering question all the way through, and one that opens up one's own feelings. Would I? Could I? Such a deeply felt book, a book about the journey to healing, written without sensation. Like the river in the title, which Corby can hear from his cell, and from which he is able to pluck a flat lucky stone. The ebb and flow is gentle to turbulent. The river is hope to Corby as he lives out his sentence, until a vicious assault robs him. The Blue Heron, another symbol of freedom. That this is a book to stop you in your tracks is a definite. So very moving. Makes you think deeply about consequences. Lamb keeps those pages turning until the very last word. The ending is surprising, and yet somehow it sadly fits. As a cliché, the story stays with you. In fact, it has haunted me since finishing the book, but in my opinion, that's a good thing. All the adjectives and phrases that other reviewers have written are so apt. I won't repeat them, but to say, read it.
Thank you.
That was Blue Fountain by the Soweto String Quartet. Welcome back. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio, our show that's sponsored by Exclusive Books, and all these books that we're talking about are available at Exclusive Books. In addition, if you've missed any of these segments and you'd like to listen back, or if you enjoyed the sound of one of these books but you couldn't remember the title or the author, we load the show as a podcast on fmr.co.za or on your app as soon as the show is finished, so you can go and check those all out. We're moving on now to our very next review, and this is an interesting one because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Riley Herbert Henry, one of our reviewers, has read the entire Booker shortlist. It's no mean feat. Some of these books, look, they're not all very thick, but some of these are very thick, and they're very well written, and some of them are very deep and very meaningful. And I think even the short ones are quite tricky reads. I think you have to really focus and concentrate. So Riley Herbert Henry set himself a real target this year. He decided he wanted to read the entire shortlist. In fact, I think he's read quite a bit of the long list too. But he focused and he read on the entire shortlist while he waited for the judges to make their decision. And he's here to tell us what he thought of the shortlist, of each of the titles on the shortlist, and more importantly, what he really thought of the 2025 Booker winner, which was Flesh by David Salze. I have been waiting for Riley to give us this lowdown on the Booker shortlist because I don't want to read the entire shortlist, but I want to listen through this and pick one or two titles and decide which ones I do want to read. And I definitely want to read Flesh because I'm always curious what wins the Booker every year. I also want to add that Riley has some really interesting thoughts on the future of the Booker Prize. Where will the future voices come from? Riley, I loved your take on the Booker shortlist. Thank you for joining us, and I'm going to hand the show over to you.
When David Salze's Flesh was announced as the winner of the 2025 Booker Prize, the room seemed to hold its breath. It wasn't the loudest book on the shortlist, nor the most overtly ambitious, but it had something else, a quiet precision, an elemental honesty. This year's shortlist felt unusually cohesive. Six novels, each circling questions of identity, the body, and belonging. Flashlight by Susan Choi, The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny by Kiran Desai, Audition by Katie Kitamura, The Rest of Our Lives by Ben Markowitz, The Land in Winter by Andrew Miller, and Salze's winning Flesh. Taken together, they read like an atlas of interiority. Stories about people searching for meaning amid the noise of the modern world. No debuts, no outsiders this year on the shortlist. Rather, a collection of writers confident in their craft, each interrogating what it means to live, to perform, to endure. Kiran Desai's The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny marked her long-awaited return, nearly two decades after The Inheritance of Loss. It's a sweeping, deeply compassionate novel that spans continents, tracing the fault lines of love, migration, and displacement. Desai writes with a rare musicality, balancing humor and heartbreak in equal measure. It's a novel that understands the ache of distance, both geographic and emotional. Andrew Miller's The Land in Winter is quieter, but equally commanding. Set in post-war England, it's a meditation on silence, grief, and the small dignities that sustain us. Miller's prose feels almost sculpted from frost. Spare, luminous, exacting. It's the kind of novel that asks for your patience and rewards it. Although this was my least favorite book on the list. Katie Kitamura's Audition pulls us into the mind of an actress whose life begins to blur with her roles. It's about identity as performance, the uneasy choreography between authenticity and artifice. Kitamura's sentences are taut and deliberate, her control of tension immaculate. I predicted she would win. That's how good this book is. Susan Choi's Flashlight glows in the margins. A novel about absence, immigrant memory, and the way we illuminate what we cannot face directly. It's unsettling and elegant, full of shadow and afterimage. And Ben Markowitz's The Rest of Our Lives offers a road trip through the American heartland that becomes, inevitably, a meditation on regret, fatherhood, and midlife reckoning. His prose feels tender, warning, quietly devastating. This book didn't have the best reviewer feedback, but I loved its simplicity. Then there's Flesh. Salze, often heralded as the writer's writer, has always been a novelist of structure and restraint. And here, he delivers his most intimate work yet. The book follows one man across a lifetime, a boy who becomes a son, a husband, a father, while the body itself becomes a site of both wonder and betrayal, its lean, muscular writing stripped of ornament, yet pulsing with emotional force. The Book of Judges called it a dark book, but a joy to read. I think that's exactly right. Flesh doesn't strive for grandeur. It looks inward, insisting that every day is epic enough. It's a reminder that the most radical act in literature might simply be to tell the truth, plainly, without apology. Saloy's win feels significant. In a year when literary prizes could easily have rewarded the expansive, the equally important global, or the overtly political, the Booker chose something smaller, sharper, more interior. It's a nod to craft over noise, to the slow burn rather than the spectacle. But it's also a choice that raises questions. With no debut authors in sight on the shortlist, are we celebrating literary mastery or merely reaffirming it? The shortlist this year was stacked with veterans, writers whose careers are already well cemented. There's beauty in that, of course, but it leaves me wondering where the next generation of Booker voices will come from. Who's taking the risks that established writers no longer need to? I've read the long list, and the most notable exclusions from the shortlist was Endling by Maria Riva, a crowd favourite debut that was longlisted this year. Also, Seascraper by Benjamin Wood, a quiet, stunning novel of circumstance. Still, I find hope in the shortlist's shared vocabulary. Across all six novels, there's a deep concern with movement. Physical, emotional, historical. Characters drift between countries, languages, selves. They search for home in fractured worlds, for meaning in the face of disconnection. In that sense, the 2025 Booker feels distinctly of its time. From a South African vantage point, it also reflects the ongoing imbalance in global literary visibility. These are magnificent novels, but they're almost entirely Anglo-American. We can admire them while still acknowledging the absences, the stories not yet making it to the shortlists, the voices that remain unheard. For small presses and new writers, that gap is an invitation. It says there's space here. There's space for voices that disrupt, that localize, that reimagine what literary fiction might look like from elsewhere. As a reader, what excites me most about this Booker season is its tension between mastery and experimentation, between the familiar and the strange. Desai's lyricism, Miller's restraint, Kitamura's precision, Choi's mystery, and Markowitz's warmth, Tis Saloy's austerity. Together, they map the current landscape of fiction. Thoughtful, humane, and occasionally, gloriously difficult. If last year's Booker was about form, then this year's was about feeling. Or perhaps the cost of feeling in a world that often numbs us. Saloy's flesh cuts to that question with a surgical precision. What does it mean to live inside a body? To love through it? To lose through it? To age within it? It's a novel that leaves you raw, but grateful. And maybe that's what the Booker is reminding us this year. That literature still matters because it hurts a little. Because it brings us closer to ourselves. Flesh by David Saloy is published by Jonathan Cape and available now through Vintage and Penguin Random House. The Booker Prize shortlist and the conversation it sparked reminds us that fiction is still our most powerful instrument of empathy. For Reimagine Lit and Book Choice, I'm Riley Herbert-Henry. Until next time, keep reading bravely and keep reimagining what stories can do. Thank you.
That was Bohemia by DNA Strings. And now we get to the interview portion of our show. Beverly Roos-Muller is here next, and she's a journalist and an author herself, and she really knows her stuff. You'll recognize her name. She's also practically a household name in South Africa. And she managed to snag a much sought-after interview with Lord Peter Hain. So what can I tell you about Lord Peter Hain? His latest book is called Liberation and Corruption, and it's about why freedom movements fail, which is quite interesting. But what interested me first when I heard that we were going to get this very sought-after interview was how he became a lord, when he became a lord, and why he became a lord. And I can tell you this, Peter Hain is a lord. His title is The Right Honourable the Lord Hain of Neath. To me, it sounds like something out of Game of Thrones. I love it. He's a life peer, and he was introduced to the House of Lords back in November 2015 after he served as a Member of Parliament for Neath from 1991 to 2015. He's billed as a British politician and activist. He's a former cabinet minister. He's also a former South African, and he has deep, deep roots in South Africa. He was born in South Africa. He was forced into exile in London in 1966 with his family because of his parents' anti-apartheid activities. So, as you can see, he goes way back. He has very deep roots here, and he has a deep, deep connection to our politics and what makes South Africa tick, which is why we are so proud and pleased and excited that Beverly Roos-Muller is here to chat to Lord Peter Hain about his latest book. Welcome to the show to you both.
Welcome to Book Choice. I'm Beverly Roos-Muller, and today we're talking to a former Pretoria schoolboy, Lord Peter Hain, famously a former disruptor of sport in the 1970s, an exile with his family in the UK, and senior British politician who remains an activist and has written 27 books. He's here to talk to us about his latest, Liberation and Corruption, Why Freedom Movements Fail. But before that, briefly, your career as a 20-year-old who managed to disrupt test matches and the whole world of sport, including ridding South Africa of international sport and resulting in your being called Hain the Pain, did that sudden global exposure prepare you for the more formal world of politics?
I suppose it must have done, because anti-apartheid politics was in my DNA through my parents. And when I found myself leading campaigns to stop all-white South African rugby, Springbok tours and cricket tours and other sports tours, I found myself propelled into that leadership. And I focused on sport because, as a white South African boy, sport was in my lifeblood as well.
Well, I think we all know how much rugby particularly meant to white South Africans, still does today. And we saw that in 1995 when we won the World Cup. And we all came together and hugged each other and thought that the world was going to be beautiful. And then that didn't quite happen. So let's go back to your current book of 27. And you've also, some of those, in fact, are novels as well as
non-fiction thrillers,
yes. And this is a kind of thriller, but sometimes in a frightening kind of way. The book usefully looks at many nations and continents that have gone through liberation struggles and then scandals. Isn't this inevitable when the have-nots suddenly come into the haves? After all, South Africa didn't pay a guilt tax, a wealth tax for centuries of privilege, and after massive challenges, then had to deal with coping with the millions.
Well, I looked into this because I was haunted by the fact of what had happened in South Africa, that the ANC of Mandela and Tambo that I'd supported as a young man and a boy, and my parents had been active alongside, suddenly seemed to betray all the struggles, all the values that it had stood for under Mandela and Tambo and their fellow leaders. And I wanted to know why. And when I looked at other liberation movements across the world, it seemed a common pattern. Once they get into power, they become corrupt. Mahatma Gandhi's Congress Party in India, not a liberation struggle, but an independence struggle, ended up the same way, in power, becoming corrupt.
Well, in fact, I wanted to talk about that because you mentioned the UK. I mean, this book covers not just South Africa, but it's global. And even you mentioned, for example, even in the UK during COVID, one in five tenders for medical supplies are now red flagged. So corruption seems to be one of those balancing acts that the world constantly having to juggle.
Yes, everybody's involved in it, every country. And the UK, as I describe, especially during COVID, but British colonialism, including in South Africa, was deeply corrupt too. And what's common is not just the tendency for people to want to self-enrich, which is a common characteristic of humankind, sadly, but also the fact that when you win power, having struggled for it over many years, you seem to think you're entitled to it, and people become more interested in exercising power than they are in actually fulfilling the mission of those liberation and independence struggles.
I remember before 94, when we were training young people to run polling stations, saying to them, you know, you're going to find out that parliamentary politics is very different to liberation politics. And they went, ha ha, you must be joking, that'll never happen with the ANC, with Congress politics. And of course it did. And I wanted to ask you, when do you think the moment happened? Was it with the arms deal? Was it with later with Zuma? When did you sense that was happening?
It became shameless and brazen under former President Zuma, that state capture decade in which a lot of the institutions and agencies that Nelson Mandela, Oliver Tambo, and even Thabo Mbeki had put in place in order to establish a new democratic future for the country with, for example, a prosecuting agency that was independent, a police service that was impartial rather than organ of the and acting in the national interest rather than as an organ of the apartheid security services. And Zuma especially dismantled all of that and perverted and corrupted them. So I think he was the principal villain, but the tendency had been in place before then. And indeed, Mandela warned about that, as I record in my book, when he was president. And it continues today. It's not that it's disappeared corruption. It's just less shameful, less shameless and less brazen than it became under Zuma and his cronies in business, the Gupta brothers.
Well, you know, I remember being in Parliament when Frederick Fonsell Slabbert, who was leader of the opposition at the time, was just leaving, and he was saying nobody becomes a Democrat faster than somebody who's about to lose power. And I think that also applies to worrying about corruption. It's fine when the old white lot were in, you know, the National Party was in power, because it was massively corrupt.
It was.
And in fact, I've written about how Vlakplaas, for example, the torture farm, was used as a cash cow for senior politicians and generals. And we tend to just ignore that whole aspect of building up of this is what you can do, this is how you teach the next generation, and they carried on with it.
Yes, the sad thing about it and the tragedy of it is that what these liberation movements, including the ANC, do on getting into office is they continue the corruption that was already there. And people have said to me, particularly my white critics, have said to me, well, apartheid may have been brutal, but at least it was not corrupt as today's South Africa is. It was deeply corrupt.
Yes.
And full of self-enrichment in the defense industry, for example, and sanctions busting and so on. But it's nevertheless, for me, deeply, deeply shameful that liberation movements have gone this way.
I want to ask you one more question while we still have time. In terms of liberation and corruption, one of the things that you said in your earlier book, A Pretoria Boy, about your school days in South Africa was, you know, you have to do something. You can't just sit around and say, oh, this is terrible. Get out and do something. What should we be doing?
I think we have to get the same spirit that drove the anti-apartheid struggle revived again for ordinary citizens to say, no, I'm not going to pay the bribe to the police officer who stops me for a spurious traffic offence. I'm not going to pay the bribe for a home affairs permit or a licence. Because unless you do that in ordinary life, you can't stop this cancer.
We've been talking today to Lord Peter Hain, ex-South African. A bit of your heart's still here, I hope.
It is.
Whose latest book, Liberation and Corruption, Why Freedom Movements Fail, published by Jonathan Ball, is on sale now.
My baby don't care for show. My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares for me, only for me.
high-toned places. Liz Taylor is not his style. And even Lana Turner's smile is something he can see. He can see. My baby don't care. My baby just cares for me. My baby don't care for shows. My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares. He cares for me. Places, mysteries, naughty stars, and even Lana Turner's smile is something he just can't see. He can see. I wonder what's wrong with baby.
I wonder what is wrong.
My baby just cares for. Sends all his prayers for
his prayers.
My baby just cares for me. Ba da 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 da. Yeah.
That was My Baby Just Cares For Me by 8 Mrs. Croon. And you are still tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. Our show is sponsored by our friends at Exclusive Books, and we are most grateful to them. We are also grateful to them for selling all the books that we talk about on our show. And we come right to the last segment of our show. We have one last interview left in this big boom buster of a show. Twanji Kalula is here now. Twanji is our reviewer who manages our money books and our business books and our motivational books. And Twanji reached out to me and he asked if he could interview Bruce Whitfield on the show today about his latest book, which is about Time Bank. And I'm always interested in all the banks in South Africa and the new and different things that we're doing. And I thought that would be a great idea. Bruce Whitfield, no stranger to radio airwaves, no stranger to South Africa, and no stranger to banking and business. So welcome to the show, Twanji Kalula and Bruce Whitfield. I'm very interested to hear about your new book, which is called It's About Time, Banking Beyond Borders, and that's by Adrian Saville and Bruce Whitfield. Welcome to the show, you guys.
The South African banking sector has been one of the most exciting areas to watch over the last 30 years and produced many success stories, including Time Bank. This once fledgling banking enterprise has remained focused on tackling financial inclusion since its inception in 2012. This year, it was named one of Time's 100 most influential companies in the world as it continues to disrupt banking in Africa and Asia. Adrian Saville and Bruce Whitfield have documented the business's journey to date in their new book, It's About Time, Banking Beyond Borders. Bruce, thank you for joining me. It's so good to be speaking to you again. A lot has changed in your life since we last spoke. You've added yourself to the list of great South African exports. And I was wondering whether living abroad has given you a different perspective on what it takes for South African businesses to thrive beyond our borders.
Yeah, Twanji, I'm hardly ever away, so I'm not too sure what we're talking about. But it's certainly I've taken on a new mantle, and I sort of like to think of myself as an international man of mystery, and I never spend enough time in one place long enough to get a perspective on anything other than whenever I'm back in South Africa, I get a renewed sense of optimism that despite the noise, despite big inquiries into the integrity of the police force or the lack of it, or the president's determination to call the ANC's bluff if they want him to resign, or all of the noise, that deep underneath the surface, there are remarkable South Africans doing remarkable things every day. And among them, the founders of a business called Time, Take Your Money Everywhere, a South African originated business bank, which is grown up in South Africa. It's got 12 million customers here. It's got nearly 8 million customers in the Philippines. It is lending money to small businesses in Indonesia. And if my instincts are right, we'll soon get a banking license there and start taking deposits as well, with plans to expand aggressively into Southeast Asia, which is why this time last year, when Konrad Jonker, the co-founder of Time, approached Adrian Saville, the business professor at Gibbs, and myself to write the story, we said, oh, yes, please, because we think there's an adventure to be told. And oh, my goodness me, there is.
I was so fascinated by that, and you do allude to it in the book, but I mean, you're without a doubt one of South Africa's most respected financial journalists, and there were challenges around balancing authorized access into telling the story with your own objective kind of perspective. And how did you and Adrian manage to navigate that?
Very simple. I'm not very good at taking instructions from anybody, essentially making myself unemployable. And so when Kun said, will you write our story? I said, sure, we can write your story. And I'd had a conversation with Adrian on this. And I said, if there is ever even a flicker, even a suggestion of intervention in the narrative, then I will walk away from the project. And, you know, if ever there is an attempt to alter the story or to alter the facts as we see them, yeah, I will walk away from the project. And I made this very clear to Kun and his team. And he was very clear on his goal as well. He said, look, I will learn things about the business that I don't know, because you will talk to people in a way that I don't talk to them. And we need to know our story, because this is a business that has its origins in the year 2020, when Kun, in 2000, I beg your pardon, when Kun was the in the first intake at Gibbs on the Gordon Institute of Business Science. He was a high-powered lawyer. He was chief executive of Edward Nathan Friedland in those days, now ENS today. He was a trained lawyer, and he was the CEO of this business. And they sent him to do an MBA because he was terribly good at law, but didn't really have too much of an idea on business. And so he did his MBA at Gibbs, then resigned from Gibbs to start a banking division within Standard Bank in 2005, which ultimately ended because square pegs and round holes that just wasn't working for the bank, even though they'd signed up a million customers. But Kun is also not one who plays by tradition and rules. And so we kind of got along from the start. And you just said, look, we're forgetting our stories. Yeah. And I think every business needs to come to this realization, as you get so busy being busy and you evolve and grow so fast that you do forget the origin story. And what Kun has done is something incredibly courageous, and that is allow a business professor, Adrian Saville, and a journalist with a nose for a story free access into the digital archive that is the story of Time Bank, plus anybody and everybody we want to talk to all about this quite remarkable story. And I'm afraid Adrian fully admits to drinking the Kool-Aid, but I'm pretty much in admiration of the main characters in the story as well, because it's been a hell of a ride.
And speaking about that ride, you know, I was just thinking about it as I was reading. I started this year talking about TJ Strayhorn's Capitec book. And the banking sector in South Africa is fascinating. It's been produced some of the biggest success stories, but it's been a bumpy ride. And the Time Bank story is so different to the Capitec story. What really intrigued you about it? Because, I mean, it felt like it was going to end many times along the way.
That is the story. It is one about the Capitec story, and TJ did a magnificent book on Capitec. And everybody knows Capitec better than they know Time, I think. And I think one of the great difficulties of telling the story is because Time's target market is very clearly the base of the economic pyramid, the 24% of people in the world who are deemed unbankable by mainstream banks. The book buying public, people who listen to this fine radio station and others, are not that familiar. They sort of see it as that bank for those people over there. And that is the thing I found really fascinating, because in the background of what is being built at Time is the most extraordinary technological story. It is a story of technology that was built in-house for many years and drew the attention of Commonwealth Bank of Australia, which for a while was invested in Time because they saw the genius of this team and wanted a piece of the action so that they could roll out digital banks in Southeast Asia. Commonwealth Bank of Australia then got into trouble of its own in its own market and sold off all of its international assets, including Time, to the founders and to African Rainbow Capital, which is Patrice Motsepe, his investment vehicle. And that's truly when the story begins in 2019, when they've got their banking license and they begin opening bank accounts for people. And that's how recently this iteration, and there have been about five iterations, and you'll have to read the book to get an understanding of how you go from a division of Standard Bank to being owned by Deloitte, to serving MTN, to being owned by Commonwealth Bank of Australia, and ultimately by being controlled by African Rainbow Capital and drawing money from investors around the world, including one of the world's most successful fintechs or financial technology businesses, the most valuable company in Brazil today, and that is a company called Nubank. It recently became the most valuable business in Latin America, and it's got 120 million customers with ambitions to grow into the United States, where it's applied for a banking license. So it's a very convoluted story, but it is a story of South African exceptionalism, of South African genius, of South Africans who are able to rise above some really difficult economic circumstances. And you think of the last 10 years in South Africa, just how tough the economy has been and how unsupportive it has been. And TymeBank has grown up in South Africa and expanded into Southeast Asia in a way that saw Time magazine earlier this year name it as one of the 100 most influential businesses in the world. And this is a company started by a law graduate from the University of the Free State and a guy with a PhD in AI from the 1990s, who is just this week actually being given an honorary PhD on top of his real PhD from Stellenbosch. So two remarkable individuals, South Africans, building a business in South Africa to be exported to growth markets around the world.
And I think that's the thing. And, you know, when the South African economy is limited, it's inspiring to hear stories of companies that are looking beyond, you know, our borders. And you touched a lot on the collaboration and the role that it's played in TymeBank's journey. And I was fascinated from a writing perspective. We've talked about many of your books on this particular show. But this time you decided to write with someone else. What was that collaboration experience like with Adrian? And how did it change the book that you may have written by yourself if you were on your own?
It certainly was very good to have adult supervision. Adrian is an economist by training. He is got a very level head on his shoulders, and he is a man of huge experience and deep thought when it comes to the way businesses are built, and he's studied many business models around the world. So I've brought the storytelling and the drama and see the quirks and the corners and put in things that make Adrian sort of quiver with fear, going, can we really put that in? Oh, yes, we should put that in, because it's all part of the story. He brings the gravitas and really pulls it all together from a global perspective to say, this is why this South African business, which is probably underrated by most people who sort of glance at it without too much depth in South Africa, make you realize that actually this is a business that is boxing above its weight all over Southeast Asia, and is taken very seriously in Southeast Asia. I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of walking anywhere with Robbie Brosen.
I have not.
Whenever you go anywhere with Robbie Brosen, it's like people just want a piece of him, because he exudes energy, positivity, and entrepreneurial zeal. I noticed with Kun as we walked around just last week, the Singapore FinTech Festival, which is one of the biggest FinTech festivals in the world. There are thousands of exhibitors speaking a language which I don't know how they understand it, but it's a new language of financial technology. And I found him getting stopped every 10 meters as we were trying to go to have a meeting and a discussion. And I was like saying, oh, you're becoming well known. He goes, something seems to be working. So he's becoming something in Southeast Asia of a standout character, because, you know, unlike many fintechs, Time has been one of the fastest into profitability and is one of the fastest growing in the world as a digital bank. And so, yeah, it is a remarkable story of South African success happening around the world.
And we'll be watching the ride. Thanks so much, Bruce. We're going to have to leave it there, but thanks for your time. It's About Time, Banking Beyond Borders by Adrian Saville and Bruce Whitfield, was published by Pan Macmillan.
And that brings us to the end of our November Book Choice show. It's been an incredible experience. I've learned a lot. One of the things that stands out to me is I was curious about becoming a lord. I kind of went down a rabbit hole and ended up Googling a whole lot of things about how you become a lord, and it's quite hard work. And I doubt I would ever be able to be an absolute real lady, but I will try my best. It was a great show. I'm very grateful to all our reviewers and all our interviewers and the publishers who send us these books. Also to the authors for taking the time to chat to us and come and give us so much insight into the work that they're doing. Dear listener, I'm very grateful for you. I hope you found something on your list here that you could add to your wish list for the reading festive season. And we do try and cover as much as we can, a bit of fiction, a bit of nonfiction, so that we can get a little bit of everything, just hoping that something rings your bell. And so with that, we're going to play out with Crazy by the Buscade Soweto String Quartet. My name is Paige Nick. You've been tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio, and I absolutely can't wait to chat to you again about books in 2 weeks' time when we join you again with Publisher's Choice. And until then, happy reading and happy listening to this incredible track. Di banjuangku we ya lubas tandanes lale madonge dum bazali ba di bizale nun ambula wa tetani nae hitani bilenda wena bazali Itani kuso, itani bilenda wena. Ivanga tumela badula ngene, aupui nomvula wa. Ivanga tumela badula bako, aupenduli nomvula wa. Nomvula. Kutheni undibethisa ngumoya sithandwa undityebisile ngeblutix kapo WhatsApp ndifuna nokuthumela abantu basekumbule ekhaya buya Toll Street was too sam ndicela uvule sithandwa sam zalaishi mothe masimini zalaisha hoko chile ndile zalaishi mothe masimini zalaisha Zalaishi mote masimini zalaisha Hakapelu nonduna wa Zalaishi mote masimini zalaisha
In the Mood, Lunch Hour Jazz on FMR.